From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for December 6, 2019. There's a plethora of Christmas activities to check out, like the Kris Kringle Market at the Fiserv Forum, Winter Wonders at the Berner Botanical Garden, and an oldie but a goodie, Candy Cane Lane in West Allis, just to mention a few. The hottest team in the NBA, your Milwaukee Bucks, are home for three games this week, and the Packers host Washington this Sunday. A newspaper in British Columbia relied too heavily on spell check. For the Christmas holiday, they ran a headline that read, "Come and have breakfast with Satan." Well, it has all the same letters as Santa. Most guys have loose change jars, but it's kind of a guy thing. Well, the guy in West Virginia decided to cash in his 6,000 pounds of pennies. He needed two cargo vans to get them to the bank. The cash value was $10,303.15. But here's his dilemma. The scrap value of 3 tons of copper would be $15,840. But that would be a felony. Oh, what to do. And finally, Willie Nelson, who belongs on Mount Rushmore, has appointed himself as chief tester and head of quality control of his own marijuana company. Well, of course he did. In the studio today, we have Kyle Tedding, Mark Amateus, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Bob Landis.
Thanks, Max. NASDAQ lost just a teeny bit of ground this week, losing 0.1%, losing 9 points, closed at the bell at 86.57. Broader markets, S&P stock composite 500 climbed 0.2%, rising 5 points to close at 31.46, with dividends now up a whopping 27.8% for the year. What a year. Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped just a tad down 0.1%, shedding 36 points. Pretty good considering how we started the week with the sell-off. Week overall, we shed 36 points with the close of the bell this afternoon in New York, with the Dow now back again above 28,000. We closed at 28,015. Year-to-date, Dow's up 22.9. You know, Kyle, let's just start with Monday. Institute for Supply Management came out with their manufacturing numbers. We'll get into the details in a bit, but the news wasn't pretty. Manufacturing continues to contract. Later that day, the president decided that he was going to declare a trade war with Brazil and Argentina over steel and aluminum markets. Got cream for the day, as you know. On Tuesday, the president announced that, well, we probably won't resolve the trade issues with the Chinese till after the election. Pretty interesting to see how the markets reacted to that. Initially, it was terrible. And then by later in the week, the market decided, you know, that's probably a good thing because maybe now it can't get worse between now and after the election. And the markets, I think, have collectively, at least for now, decided that, all right, if it can't get worse because they're not going to talk to each other until after the election, at least we know what we're dealing with. You know, and then finally the employment report came out. Pretty good number. You got to adjust for the fact of the GE strike. But overall, it looks like we're maybe shedding some of the problems with the trade conflict. I mean, as you know, the market rallied for 5 weeks in a row just on the rumors that we were talking to the Chinese. I mean, that doesn't mean we're agreeing on anything or getting anything done. But potentially now, unless the trade wars intensify with Argentina and Brazil, maybe it's back to the good old-fashioned, let's look at earnings and interest rates.
And, Bob, you know, I think the market has priced a lot of that in. When you look at the fact that stocks aren't cheap anymore, you look at forward PEs, they're a little bit above long-term averages now. You look at things like volatility measures or the VIX index not really showing any signs that, at least in the near term, stocks are going to bounce around all that much. You look at high yield spreads or what investors are demanding to invest in lower quality bonds, and there's just nothing out there that suggests that investors are all that concerned about what's to come. There's not a lot of, I think, fear at least priced into the market right now. And so, you know, I think for us, that maybe suggests that now's the time to sell into some of that opportunity. If you've got required distributions you've got to take still this year, you know, obviously you can't wait much longer, so let's maybe trim some of those gains. If you're looking at what do we do next year, it's positioning into quality right now, because you're just, again, the markets aren't anticipating risk. And so what happens if we see some? You know, as you say, if we're not going to talk about the trade war now through the end of the year, things can't get worse, but they also can't get better. And so, you know, I'm encouraged by the fact and cautiously optimistic about the direction we're headed. You know, at the same time, I think we've rightfully been positioning a little more defensively for the better part of a year now, with the understanding that as things have gotten more expensive, you know, there's just not as much opportunity out there anymore.
Kyle, you got to be worried about what's going on in the credit markets the last couple of weeks. You've seen the lack of liquidity. You've seen drains on funding for overnight money, for money market funds. The Fed got forced to inject an enormous amount of money the other day into the overnight markets, a little bit different than credit-backed derivatives that blew up prior to the financial crisis. But nevertheless, when you see short-term funding problems, we're not talking about dedicating long-term money here. We're talking about overnight money. That potentially can be a problem.
You know, and I think the concern for so many investors is that they assume that that is something that's going to be safe. And so if you run into a liquidity event, if you run into some unexpected volatility and money that so many people believe should be higher quality, you know, that can certainly shake confidence. And so for investors, incredibly important to have just more than one source of safe money, incredibly important to really plan ahead for what withdrawal needs are, plan ahead to make sure that, you know, you're not relying on just one source of liquidity. And I think that can alleviate some of those concerns. But the other piece is, we're also starting to hear rumors that some of the rating agencies maybe have overrated some of the debt issuance that's out there. And so, you know, you go back to what we saw pre-financial crisis, where maybe the rating agencies weren't completely understanding those issues. And it, you know, I think places even more emphasis on the need to be high quality right now.
Well, you would think from the financial crisis that the United States would have learned its lesson and changed the model where you have to pay a rating agency for the rating, and you get to pick and choose your rating agency. And you know there are conversations of, here, I'm going to pay you a ton of money, but before we start, how are you going to rate me? That, you know, there's got to be another way to do it. We've said a couple of upstart companies that charge differently haven't gotten a lot of traction yet. But that's certainly one of the problems. And you and I have talked to bond managers in the past. They don't even trust the rating agencies. They just come out and say it. They do their own research because they know literally that rating agencies can be bought. They are bought because you're paying for the rating.
And I think that's key, Bob, is understanding that it's not enough in bond markets to simply buy the index and say, I've got quality. It's about really trusting the teams that you work with, really trusting the portfolio managers, that they're doing their due diligence on each of those issues. And, you know, just to maybe put a finer point on what you were talking about with, you know, picking and choosing your rating agencies, you know, you need only look at the city of Chicago and who they've chosen not to rate their bonds, because one particular rating agency gave them a bad rating once. They're not going to give them any more business. And so you're spot on with that comment that it's so easy, I think, to direct business to the firms, the rating agencies that are going to be favorable to you. And that's why, you know, so critically important that when we look at mutual funds, when we look at potential investment for portfolios for clients, it's having a good conversation with management about how they look at risk.
Joel, let's bring you into the program here. Labor Department came out with their reports this morning. Created a lot of jobs last month.
Yeah, it was a pretty good-looking report overall, Bob. They said that the employers added 266,000 jobs in November, and that was the 110th month in a row that the country has done that, and that's more than double the previous record for the length of job gains like that. The unemployment rate went down, and that was unexpected. It didn't go down much, but it went down to the lowest rate since December of 1969. So there were a lot of good things to see in that labor report.
We had the manufacturing number that came out, Institute of Supply Management on Monday, not so good.
Right, and later in the week, we also had the Institute for Supply Management number on the non-manufacturing part of the economy. And a difference, you know, in what we've been talking about so far is the manufacturing is more dependent on the global economy, and the non-manufacturing is less dependent. It's more reflective of the domestic economy, and the ISM, the non-manufacturing index, has been showing that that part of the economy has been growing for 118 consecutive months. That's a long time. But as you point out, the manufacturing one is more concerning because that's showing 4 months in a row of basically contracting. So it's showing that, you know, manufacturing, at least that part of our economy, is actually sort of in a recession.
Mark, let me put you on the spot. What do you think investors should expect for next year?
Bob, I think that for the most part, the idea of a recession next year is pretty much off the table, at least for what we see now. I think the numbers in the labor market, unemployment rate, as you guys were talking about, looks really good. You know, normally you see an uptick in unemployment leading into a recession as businesses start getting a little more careful. They see things on the horizon that maybe they don't like so much, and so they start holding back. But boy, you know, a recent survey of small business owners, their number one concern was labor. They just can't find enough qualified workers for what they want to do. You know, and a positive of that with the full employment is it's kind of looks like it's spilling over into some real good consumer spending numbers, holiday spending. Those 5 days between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday was up 16% from last year. So, you know, you've got some pros and cons with the tight labor market. But on the other hand, good consumer spending, I think, because people are securing their jobs and looking forward to a pretty good year.
And, Mark, there was also the consumer sentiment report that came out today from the University of Michigan, and that is reflecting the fact that, you know, people are needed to work, and so people feel more confident. And the fact that stock prices have been up also feeds into that wealth effect where consumers are, you know, feeling that they've got money to spend. So hopefully that'll help the holidays.
You know, for years we've used the term Black Friday, and even on occasion have said it's historically when the average retailer turns a profit the day after Thanksgiving. So I was pretty surprised to read that that's not at all accurate. The term Black Friday comes from the late 1800s when two individuals tried to corner the silver market and it collapsed on a Friday. And that's the origin of the term Black Friday. So the concept of it's when retailers go into profit, go into the black, isn't even at all accurate. So the fact that we now refer to this big shopping day the day after Thanksgiving as Black Friday actually refers to a silver panic in the late 1800s. So I think we're going to have to go back to the drawing board on that and maybe call it something else. You know, Kyle, when you look at the markets now, I think it's so fascinating that, you know, the markets are way up for the year, but earnings didn't go anywhere. I think it's also interesting to look at the earnings for next year. They're already starting to come down with their estimates. And now we're in the high single digits. We were in the low double-digit range just a couple months ago. So there isn't any correlation in a given year between stock prices and earnings. You know, we had last year earnings weren't so bad. Market lost ground. This year, earnings are basically flat for the year, and the market's up quite a bit. So I say this by way of looking at next year and looking at earnings now that they're, you know, down into the 9% range, and wondering if this market hasn't gotten a little bit ahead of itself, you know, relative to that point.
You know, I think two things to consider here. One is that we've said so often that earnings are a key piece of the direction long-term that stocks take. But I think the other piece is obviously interest rates. And then the other piece you bring in here is that it's also about valuations. And so if you bring it back to the start of 2019, and yeah, the earnings forecast wasn't all that great, but stocks were a little bit cheap then. You know, maybe not historically cheap, but certainly not as expensive as they are now. And so just some of what we've seen this year was a closing of that gap. Add in the fact that interest rates are incredibly low, and it just made stocks more attractive. It made investors more willing to bid up the price of stocks because the alternative, you know, 1.5% or 2% on a 10-year bond, depending on when in the year you bought it, wasn't nearly as attractive. And so, you know, I think a lot of the return this year was simply a reflection of those two pieces and less about earnings themselves. Now, fast forward to 2020, and you're talking about stock prices that maybe are a little bit overvalued now. You're talking about still interest rates, though, that are pretty cheap. And so when you look at the relationship between what could I get on a dollar invested in the stock market versus a dollar invested in bonds, you know, I think investors are still going to be inclined to see the opportunity in stocks, even at slightly overvalued. And so, you know, I think the challenge now is if that 9.8 or 9.9% forecast for next year comes down to 6 or 7 or even 8, what does that really mean for how we're actually pricing stocks right now? It probably means, okay, maybe the 7 or 8% a year that we normally see in stocks or that we'd expect to see in stocks right now comes down in line with that. And so an average year from these prices looks more like 4 or 5 than it does 7 or 8. And so, you know, I think we've been talking to clients about it, adjusting their expectations. You factor in the great year we had this year, and I think we'd be happy with a year like that next year for stocks. And, you know, certainly I think the more we back off expectations for earnings, the more likely it is we see something a little bit more muted for stock returns next year.
You know, forecasts for recessions are notoriously difficult because so many variables. But, Mark, I'm not so sure that, you know, recession's not in the cards for next year. We certainly know trend line. GDP was 3% in the first quarter, 2% the second quarter, 1.8% third quarter, give or take. So we know that things are slowing. But what I find so curious about predicting recessions is that we're not being asked to predict particular data points. I mean, if that was the case, we'd be fairly accurate. But what is being asked is to predict a crisis of confidence. So it's psychological. If you think back to the financial crisis, I mean, housing at the time was about 11% of the economy. Measurable number, not a huge number. But people panicked when their houses plunged in value. Quarter of the country all of a sudden upside down on their houses, owe more than their houses are worth. You need a car to get to work. You don't need a new car. You got to educate your kids, but you don't need to send them to private schools. You got to go on a vacation, but you can go up and camp in the woods. And people literally panic when their houses plunge. Look at Y2K as another example. Tech stocks at the time weren't that a huge piece of the economy. But then Enron blew up, right? World's largest bankruptcy, largest in the United States ever. Month after that, WorldCom blew up. A couple weeks after that, Sun Microsystems, everybody's favorite tech stock in the 90s, disappeared. And then to gild the lily, 9/11 came along. And it was that crisis of confidence where people jammed the brakes on and said, honey, let's wait till the dust clears. I don't feel comfortable spending money. And that's the nature of a recession. It's not a particular data point. It's when people start to panic. And that's what's so frustrating about trying to predict recessions. And it's why a lot of people shouldn't even try. Because the whole essence, as you know, Mark, of building a balanced portfolio is, number one, you don't get paid for taking a whole lot more risk than 65-ish% of stocks at all. But number two, it allows you to have a comfortable defensive position because of how mind-numbingly complex it is to predict recessions. And what I find so curious, having done this now for almost 45 years, is the human condition is such that people really want to know what the future is going to look like. And as a result, they're susceptible to suggestions. Good, bad, or indifferent. Really, you can give me a clue as to what next year is going to be like? I'm all ears, right? People really, really want to know. And the problem is, what's being asked is something that is almost impossible to predict. I mean, think back to the Persian Gulf crisis. Our own CIA didn't see Saddam Hussein's army march into Kuwait City. Didn't even see it, right? Created a recession. Look back at the Arab embargo, right? The simple idea, let's turn the spigot down and quadruple the price of oil, created one of the worst recessions since the Depression at that point. Nobody called it. How could you call that, right? And so, you know, that's the very nature of the beast. We know that things are slowing now. But what I think is important, and in part this reinforces your point, you know, there's two areas of the economy that are being hit right now in the United States. One is manufacturing. It's not big enough, right? And the second is agriculture. Same point. One of my favorite areas of investing is agriculture. You got to eat, right? And the stocks are doing poorly. But as a percentage of GDP, they're not big enough. I mean, if you do the math and give manufacturing a haircut, give agriculture a haircut, we're still in positive territory. You know, we've talked in the past about lower interest rates, and we know it can take almost a year for the effects of lower rates to kick in. They lowered rates first time in July. Folks, what we're talking about is next summer we'll finally feel the effects of lower rates. We've talked about how helpful they're going to be this time around. Only time will tell. You know, I mostly share your idea that I don't know that we're going to see a recession next year, but things sure are slowing globally. And I think one of the keys is going to be China. I mean, there are areas of the Chinese economy that are slowing that have nothing to do with tariffs, that are internal issues, internal problems they created they're going to have to solve, and they have nothing to do with the pushing and shoving with the Trump administration. But I think that it's also helpful to remind listeners that the average recovery from a recession is 23 months. Blink of an eye, it's over. So we're talking about the peak to the trough, back to the prior peak, is a little bit less than 2 years. By the time most people find out we're in a recession, it's half over, which is why the average person shouldn't futz with their accounts as you head into downturns. Because it's not so much we're going to be in a recession or not, because they tend to be over fairly quickly. I think it's to make sure, no matter when, that your portfolio is properly balanced, because recessions can come out of thin air like they did on a 9/11. I mean, nobody predicted that on that Tuesday morning. How could you? So you got to be prepared really any time for the markets to go against you. But I'm on your side. I think that the odds have gone down somewhat for next year. Kyle, let me ask you about the bond market for a minute. You know, the 10-year Treasury is backed up quite a bit. We hit a low with the yield at 1.3. Now the yield is at 1.8. 50 basis point increase in the 10-year since early August, give or take. Pretty good run-up in yields.
Yeah, and, you know, investors have to remember that inverse relationship between bond interest rates or bond yields and the prices of their underlying bonds. And so, you know, from the outset, that might be a scary concept that if we're up, you know, 50 basis points on the 10-year Treasury, that means a pretty big jump. You figure a bond with a duration of 4 years, a 50 basis point move would be a 2% decline in the value of your bond. But remember also where we started the year at almost, 2.7% on the 10-year. And so while you're talking about a 50 basis point increase, we're still almost 100 basis points below where we started. And so that gave us a lot of cushion earlier in the year for bond investors. You know, if you held even short or intermediate term bonds in your portfolio, you've made quite a bit of money in bonds this year. And so I think you're willing to dismiss maybe a return to a more normal rate for the 10-year and what that meant for a little bit of a decline in your bond portfolio, given what you got earlier in the year.
Well, folks, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. We enjoyed doing the program. We appreciate you listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.